When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nick Frank, from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
I'm well. How's it going, buddy?
Going good. I'm excited because coming up at in just a couple of weeks now is CMTS,
yes.
The Canadian Manufacturing and Technology Show. So you and I are going to CMTS together on Monday, the 4th of October. So if anyone listening would like to join us, hit me up in the DMs on Instagram or send me an email, send me a telegram, whatever you want to do. And we will go hang out and look at some awesome, cool machines.
I'm so stoked.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
There's some stuff I really want to check out that I can't afford.
Yeah, me too. And I kick the tires on some really fancy shit that I have no need for.
Yeah, exactly.
How's everything else going, man?
Good. Yeah. Well, you know, it's we got a new employee starting in October.
So we
just have been going through the whole hiring process, which, you know, is always interesting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
any highlights?
It's funny, you know, I'm not going to like disparage anybody, but you do get like people who just ask dumb questions or like really fuck up like one little thing that's like, how hard was that? Like, don't ask me where, like, how to apply. Like, it's in the job where, you know, like,
right.
I did this. I was like, okay, if somebody's interested in a job with us, how do you find out about it? Google Frank Brothers hiring or guitar job Toronto. Like, I did it like 10 different ways and it was popping up super quick.
Yeah, and if someone can't find that out for themselves or doesn't have the motivation to find it out for themselves, it's not a good sign for their like commitment to independent learning.
Yes. Well, I was listening to Within Tolerance podcast, great podcast. You were on it.
Mm-hmm. I was.
And one of the people being interviewed said that they intentionally didn't put their contact information on the job listing. It was just like a simple little test. If you can't figure out how to get in touch with me about this, then
I like it.
You're dumb. Right. I mean, it was just stuff like that. Like, you know, I interviewed someone really good candidate. And then at the end, they were like, so I can only work part time. I'm like, well, this is a full time job. That was a 30-minute interview.
Right.
So
what is this new person going to be doing?
They're going to be doing setup and assembly of the actual finished guitar.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So
they're coming in with some skills then.
Yes. So we were looking for somebody with experience. And that was the other thing. You get a lot of candidates who are like, I would love to learn how to do this, which is fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's great. It's not what we were looking for. So we actually ended up hiring somebody from who's going to move here from Calgary.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. You know, this is a weird thing that people, you know, I've heard other business owners talk about. Like, you get a great candidate, but they have to move for the position. It's a bit scary to have someone do that.
Yeah, because then if they're like shit,
yeah,
and you have to fire them,
yeah,
no, you feel extra bad.
Yeah, so it's a little scary, but I think, you know, hopefully we've done a good job in vetting this person, and their qualifications are very well aligned. So it's not like, you know, I think we can get this person can hit the ground running.
So did they come to Toronto for the interview or?
No. I mean, we haven't interviewed anybody in person. Right. We didn't interview in person for the last job we hired for, which worked out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I would like to, but, you know, pandemic.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And this guy was in Calgary.
Yep.
So
crazy.
Yeah, no, I'm excited, and our goal is to get Tim to sort of fire Tim from that job and get him focused on sales, marketing, general business management, stuff like that. He's still going to do like some high level finish stuff, like spraying color and scraping binding and things like that that are sort of some Hallmark stuff for us.
Right.
But it's a little scary to hand over any task. This is a particularly like important task.
Yeah.
But it's also the kind of task that, you know, somebody with experience in this could do, can do really well. You know, somebody who, like a guitar maker, that's who we ended up hiring, or somebody who like, you know, does repair, set up like a guitar store or touring bands. So it was, it seemed like almost the easiest thing to hire for, because it's a niche thing that there are, that people are specifically trained in.
Right. Gotcha. Interesting. So is, so for people that don't know, Tim is Nick's twin brother. They started the company together, and yeah, Tim's always been like the finish guy, the setup guy. Is he excited to get away from that?
Or I think, I think so. I think he's excited to focus himself like on the, you know, working on the business, not working in the business.
Right.
And that's just key to growth. We can't hold on to these tasks forever. And we were really slow to give some of them up in the first place. Like even with the jobs we have people doing right now.
Right.
We used to do every single little thing.
Oh yeah. I know that feeling.
And every single little thing is super important.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's hard to give these things up. So we kind of just have to, you know, fight that urge, resist that urge to hold on to it. And yeah, so it's a step in the right direction for the business. And the other stuff is what's killing us. You know, we can get
right.
You know, Tim's really good at assembling guitars, but the other parts of the business are suffering. So we tried hiring for that, and that was the last guy we hired who we let go.
Okay. You tried hiring like a business person.
Kind of, yeah. Somebody to do sales and stuff. And it's
right.
People want to talk to us, like one of the Frank Brothers when they're buying a Frank Brothers guitar.
Right.
Anyways, yeah, there was that. And then we're just in crunch mode where we're, you know, our fiscal year ends in like November. So that comes fast, and there's a lot to do in advance of that, like getting a lot of guitars out the door.
Yeah, I'm actually facing the same thing, because I told, so my mortgage broker got me, you know, approved for X amount of dollars for my mortgage, contingent on a stated income of X, you know, and I had to provide a whole bunch of like documentation to support that and so on. But now, because I didn't go ahead because you didn't buy that place, I still want to keep that approval for that amount of money. And that means that I have to earn what I told the bank I was going to earn.
Yeah.
Which was a little aggressive, let's be clear.
You're setting goals.
So, yeah, so now I've got to push.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably motivating.
Motivating and stressful. Yeah, yes. But I am making, I've been making some big changes over the last couple of weeks. So I spent a little bit of time early this week making all new fixtures for machining the handle scales. Cool. And those are all on my other CNC machine, on Millie.
Yes.
So
now metal machining is on
Vicky,
which is the enclosed machine.
That's correct.
And then all your, what else other than handle scales would you do on that machine? Oh, foam? You do foam?
No, not foam. I have all my packaging water jet cut.
So.
So it would be plastic for sheaths.
Right.
It would be stock preparation for G10. It would be handle scales for G10 for handle scales, I should say. So I mean, that's already been paying dividends. Like, you know, today I was machining blades and machining handle scales at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. So yeah, it would be nice to be doing that in an enclosed machine. I'm a little paranoid about the dust from that shit.
Right.
But I do have like a 250 CFM, like HEPA certified dust collector plumbed onto that machine, right to like the nose of the spindle. Mm-hmm. And I also have two air cleaners in my shop that are 1,000 CFM each, both with HEPA filters. So I'm changing the complete air in the shop every 3 minutes.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That's good. I saw those. They look pretty serious. With good filters.
Yes, they are. Yes, I think I need to replace the filters, actually. But yeah, like, you know, all of that shit in the filters is shit that's not in my lungs. So
which is good. Yeah.
Yeah. No one likes shit in their lungs.
I mean, the lungs are the body's filters.
Yeah, totally. One of the other random things that I did was I kind of hate vacuuming like the hard milling chips off my fixtures. It's super annoying.
Oh, you vacuum so them, eh? Oh, yeah, they're so fine.
Yeah, if you hit them with an air blast, you just blow them straight up into the tool changer and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I thought I would try a chip fan. I don't know if you've seen those. Yes,
yeah, yeah.
So for anyone that hasn't seen one, they're super cool. It looks like a little aircraft propeller, except each blade is kind of sprung. It has like a pivot and a spring. So when it's not spinning, they hang straight down to make the fan, you know, only 2 inches in diameter. But then when you spin it up, it expands and it becomes like 10 or 12 inches in diameter.
Is it actually big?
Mounts in a tool holder. Yeah, it's pretty big. And it actually mounts in a tool holder. So the spindle is what runs it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been working super well. It doesn't blow any chips into the tool changer. It gets even big kind of chunks of steel, blows them off the table.
What RPM are you spinning it at?
4,000.
Is that the max that you can?
It says on the box that it's rated for 15,000 RPM. Oh. But this was a $50 like AliExpress special or Amazon special. So I don't know if I want to spin that thing at 15,000 RPM.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, you can buy like pretty serious ones, like Big Kaiser makes one.
Yes. Yes. They're like the original kind of, they bought the rights for that off Lang.
Air compressor. Oh, it was a Lang thing, eh?
Yeah, I believe so, at least. And yeah, those are really expensive, though. They're like $500 US for a fan, you know? Yeah, I don't know, but like this thing's made really nicely. Like anodized aluminum body, all of the fan blades are fiberglass reinforced nylon, like injection molded. I wouldn't be surprised if it lasts me an extremely long time. So yeah, it's been working really well so far.
Yeah, that rules. I'd be curious like how that would work for us. I mean, it would definitely blow some wood chips. But kind of don't want to get them in the air. Once they're settled, we should be vacuuming them up.
Yeah. But that I think is a pain. You guys would be a lot better. Yeah, you guys would probably be a lot better served by dust collection of some.
Yes. So I did. Actually, I have so hooked up some dust collection to this, but it's not that good yet.
Right. So there's a really cool dude by the name of Werner Berry, and he runs a YouTube channel and a company called BerryBot3D, and he does a lot of really awesome stuff. He's been working on a machine-tended Tormach CNC mill. So he has a part that he makes like thousands and thousands of every year. It's like an electronics bus bar made out of plastic. And so he's actually like evolved that process to the point where it's like fully machine tended. It runs 24 hours a day, cool. Like unattended. Wow. Yeah, it's super cool. And for that application, he has to make sure that there are no chips flying around, because otherwise there might be chips in the way when the robot's trying to, you know, put the new part, the new stock in place, that kind of stuff. So he actually came out with this really clever idea. Basically, you have, you install like a vertical rail next to the Z axis of your milling machine. And you have a like a dust chute. I don't know if you've seen like a dust chute on a CNC router. It has like brushes that go around the spindle.
Yeah.
So the idea is that the dust chute is mounted to the track and it's perfectly in line with the spindle, but it's spring loaded and it only goes up to a certain amount, you know, say 12 inches off the table. And then above that, the spindle keeps going and separates from the dust chute. So you do your tool changes above the dust chute. And then whenever you're moving the spindle down toward the table, it kind of collects the dust chute on the way. And then the dust chute moves with the spindle. And he gets like literally zero chips, you know, outside of this system. That might be something that would work really well for you.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I mean, I've been racking my brain because I saw your setup, which I thought was clever.
Yeah, so mine's just like the company Lockline that make those little blue kind of bendy coolant tubes. They make big ass ones for vacuum, and mine is kind of based on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I looked into that, but yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, a solution that would be more active and less passive, you know. So, what I mean by that, like, just pointing a nozzle at one section of the we make a lot of wood dust and wood chips.
Yeah,
just pointing it at one section. You know, if we're like, sometimes the chips are flying to the, you know, left of the spindle, and sometimes they're flying to the right of the spindle, depending on what, where, you know, how we're cutting. So I feel like it would only solve, you know, half of the problem.
And yes. Yeah. And for me, that's absolutely the case. Like, there are a lot of big chips that escape. In my case, I'm really concerned about the fine dust. And
true. That is a bigger problem.
That nozzle does a very good job of collecting the fine dust. And then the heavy chips that have enough mass to kind of keep going against the airflow, they get thrown away. You know?
Right.
Like, they, and then I can just vacuum them up later or whatever.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah.
But that spindle, that moving spindle shroud, like the spindle dust shoe that that Werner made, that thing, it looks amazing.
And I'm gonna have to look at that.
Yeah, I'm thinking more about making one.
Yeah.
Because really, the biggest problem with my nozzle system, and the reason it's not more effective, is that I have to keep it far enough away from the spindle to allow tool changes to happen. Because it moves with the spindle all the time.
Right.
If it wasn't for that limitation, I could have it a lot closer. It would do a much better job of collecting dust, you know. So
it's a really good idea. I'm trying to think of how we could do something similar. Does it surround the spindle 360 degrees once it comes down?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's a fucking
good idea. You know, so if you needed to, you could have like a little slot left in it so that your air blast could poke through or whatever, but like, yeah, it's a super good idea. Very, very clever.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, because there's not a lot of room also on this machine, you know, because the side mount tool changer and the air blast, and then the coolant ring kind of gets in the way as well. Not that we need
that. Yeah, then you could always take the coolant ring off.
Yeah.
But, yeah. My cat is singing me a song. So one other really cool thing, it actually relates. We got a listener. Let me see if I wrote their name down. Of course I didn't. We had a listener write in and say that I should be having a look at Bax EDM. So I'm just going to find the person that sent this. So Bax EDM is this guy from the UK that decided he wanted to make a DIY wire EDM. And so he designed like the spark generator and everything to make that possible. And the spark generator is by far the most complicated part. It's like the part that controls the electrical discharge in the electrical discharge machining system. And Werner Berry, the same guy we were just talking about, built from the ground up a completely custom wire EDM.
Oh, that wow.
Works beautifully. Like, he's cutting carbide with it, he's cutting tool steels, like it's pretty crazy.
So is this a kit?
No, it's, so you buy the spark generator as a standalone unit. It's like literally like a rack mount unit that will talk to like a CNC control.
Okay.
And then you have to build the rest of the system yourself.
Holy shit.
Like all the wire tensioning, all that kind of stuff. I think Bax EDM have like plans to like help you out with it. So the listener that wrote in to tell us about this was Custom Caffeine on Instagram. So, and he makes some super cool coffee machine parts and upgrade stuff.
Oh, sweet.
So go check him out. Thank you for writing in. Yeah, I love the idea of this kind of stuff where like the spark generator is where all the magic is in an EDM machine. So being able to just buy one and then build your own custom machine around it is really cool.
Yeah. This is crazy. That'd be a lot. I mean, what else would go into this? Now you just need the linear motion.
Yeah, linear rails, ball screws, the wire feed mechanism, all the tensioning stuff, and then the actual CNC controller itself and the motion control. So, I mean, you'd probably be looking at, like, still, you know, 18 or 20 grand to build one. But I've been talking to, you know, companies like salespeople about WireADM, and you're not getting into a new WireADM for less than 100 grand.
Right.
So it's a big difference.
It is.
Yeah. Though, honestly, the one thing that stops me from doing it is that for WireADM to be really useful for me, I need automatic threading, which is where it actually, like, takes the wire, cuts it, threads it through an existing hole in your workpiece, and then can start cutting all by itself.
How the hell does that happen? How do they do that?
It's actually really cool. They so they anneal the wire by passing a current through it to heat it up and then cool it to, I believe, basically just to make it kind of softer in that one section. And then they cut the wire actually by, like, stretching it. Rather than, like, snipping it. Because when you snip it, you make a little burr on the end, and it's going to be wider than the wire itself is. So they either snip it and then shape the end, or they actually, like, stretch it to make it break. And before it breaks, it necks, so it actually gets thinner. And then they turn on the high-pressure water jet, and they use the water jet to guide the wire through the hole and down into the lower guide of the system. And yeah, the reason that they have to make sure that the wire doesn't get any bigger is because the wire guides that you know hold the wire in place are incredibly tight tolerance relative to the wire to make sure the wire can't move around.
Right.
And yeah, like the tension on the wire is like guitar string level tension.
Crazy.
Like, you know, a high E is kind of like the same ballpark thickness and tension as like the wire in a wired EDM, which is pretty nuts.
It's like 10 thou.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 10 to 12 thou is like the most common wire size, I think.
So you still are interested in buying one? Or are you going to make
one? So, I don't know whether we talked about this or not, but so I have been working on the fixtures for the kitchen knife, which was, you know, so basically, my motivation for wanting a wired EM was to be able to take a rectangle of hardened steel, put it in the CNC mill, machine one whole side, flip it, machine the other side, like do all the 3D contouring and everything, but not cut it out, and then put it into the wired EM and cut it out.
Yeah.
And that means I'd be able to have really simple fixtures, blah, blah, blah. So it'd be like two and a half, three operations, basically, right? I've actually managed to work out how to get the same results. I mean, not quite as good as WireADM in terms of accuracy, but more than good enough, I think, for my purposes, in just two operations on the mill.
Oh, well, that sounds like a home run. How'd you do
that? Yeah, I've been really pleased with how it's been working out, actually. So we talked a couple of episodes about the first operation is just I'm literally like using tape and super glue. Yeah. To like hold the part, and then I'm hard milling this chunk of steel that's held down with tape and super glue, which is, it boggles my mind that works, but it has been completely reliable, which is bonkers. And then in that first operation, after I'd done all the 3D contouring, I machine a series of bolt holes around the edges of the knife, and then a pair of locating holes. So I flip it onto the second operation, which has some dowel pins for location, and then I bolt it down. There are a whole bunch of bolts. And then basically in the tang of the knife, in the handle of the knife, there on the underside, there are actually some flats that I machine in the first operation that sit on these posts that are part of the fixture. Mm-hmm. And they like line up, you know, within a thousandth. They're literally like, you know, a light contact fit. And then I actually machine through from the top in the second operation in those locations to make bolt holes and flats for bolt heads. And I bolt down through the handle after a bunch of the other machining is done. Mm-hmm. And okay. Also when I'm putting the blade down on op two, I just put a little bit of hot glue underneath the blade.
Right.
And then by changing the sequence of operations, so what I do is I machine the profile of the blade, I machine like the handle and the spine, but I don't cut the edge. So the edge is really important in terms of thickness and shape, but not at all important in terms of surface finish.
Right.
That makes sense. Because I'm just going to sharpen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I cut the edge last, and that means the edge provides support for the whole length of the blade while I'm machining the spine. And then I do a bunch of passes back and forth along the spine with a little tool going in a ramp to kind of machine that whole profile of the knife out. And then after I've done all that, I just do a single pass along the edge, cut it out, and it's done.
Okay.
And it's bonkers how well it works, honestly.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So maybe I don't need a warrior.
So now you can get a new mill at
yes,
CMTS.
Maybe. Yes. I will be definitely looking at Okuma while I'm there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, the biggest motivation for the wire EDM, you know, with that stated use case, is that it would have really drastically changed my abilities. But now I'm getting that without it. So, yeah, I don't know.
Right. Well, so something with better surface finishing would be the next thing to tackle.
Yes. And obviously, like, a new machine is shiny and everyone wants one. Mm-hmm. But the price tag that it comes with is pretty bonkers as well. Like, the Okuma Genos M560V, which is probably where I'd end up. It's either that or like a Haas VM series.
Yeah.
So the Okuma is like 130K US and the Haas VM series are like 85, 90 ish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a lot of money. There is a company in the States called CalMotion, which is one of a couple of companies that make retrofit controls for the Fidal.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been talking to those guys and it's been really interesting actually. So basically, the control retrofit that they sell is literally a 5-minute job. Like, it just, you pull out the old control cards, you slot in the new ones, and that's it.
Cool.
Like, it just works. You go through and set up the parameters, like, you tell it what size machine it is and what spindle speed you have, and you're done. It's pretty bonkers. oh my God, my cat's losing his mind over here. And they have a money-back guarantee if you don't see the results you want. So they've said, if I don't get the surface finish improvements I'm looking for, I just send the control back.
Okay.
No big deal. And that control upgrade actually increases the resolution of DC servo Fidals by double.
That sounds good.
Yeah. So, and it has, like, the original Fidal control doesn't have any, like, acceleration or deceleration or ramping control. It just sends it, you know. Sorry, I'm just letting my cat out here. Okay, buddy, yeah, go on.
Sounds like your cat lost his parameters.
Yeah, seriously. He's a noisy boy. He's a big boy, too. He's like 20-something pounds.
Oh, that's how much my child weighs.
Yeah, he's a big cat. He's not fat, though. He's just giant. He's
super
a breed of cat called... Yeah, he's a breed of cat called a Maine Coon. And the biggest examples of those guys grow up to like 48 inches from nose to tail.
Oh my God, sounds scary.
Nah, he's pretty cool. When he lies down in the bathtub, though, he takes up more than 2/3 of the bathtub, like in length.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's a big boy.
Link to a photo of your big cat in the show notes.
Well, if you go on the xyz.cnc Instagram, the very first post that I ever put on there is my cat sitting in my 3D printer.
So you printed this cat.
Sorry, if you haven't seen that. Yeah, I printed him. He's the best print of all time. Yeah, so this retrofit control, like,
so
kind of sounds like it might be a good idea.
Is it expensive?
It is $8,000 US.
Okay, so not cheap.
But not crazy.
Not crazy. I mean, you know, a lot like cheaper than 10 times that for a new Haas.
Yes. And, like, I don't really need new Haas performance or new Okuma performance. I just need, like, 10, 20% better than what I've got now. In terms of surface
finish. Well, I mean, I saw the surface finish on your knives. It's quite good, except for in this one little spot.
Thank you. Yeah, it's just... So basically, to explain to everybody else what's happening, I'm 3D contouring the bevels of my blades, and I'm doing that with a parallel toolpath. So it's just going back and forth across the blades from spine to edge and edge to spine, you know, stepping over, I think it's like 3/1000ths at a time, going back and forth. And that looks amazing in the section of the blade that has a straight edge where the bevel is flat. It's like perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could, you know, if I shipped a knife straight to a customer with that finish, they'd be like, oh, this has obviously come off a machine, but it's nice, you know. The problem is when the bevel starts to curve down toward the tip, because
it comes to a point at the tip.
Yeah, you know, it has to curve along with the edge that's curving upward, you know, in order to give that kind of taper. And when the machine is interpolating the passes for the, you know, that are kind of gently lowering down toward the tip, it almost gets like stair steps. You know, it can't quite make a perfectly smooth curve. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's kind of stepping down. And unfortunately, that is like, it's visible. And, you know, if I like sandblast the knife, it's still visible. If I, you know, go to hand finish, then those little kind of stair steps are like ridges that I have to get rid of. So that is actually something that drives a lot of manual labor in my process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't have to hand sand the blades if that didn't happen.
Seems like an important thing to tackle. Do you see it
in
the...
And I've been trying to tackle it for years.
Do you see it in the machine?
Like, do you see the machine...
Struggling in that area.
Differently? Like, no, not at all. And because it's... I don't think it's really struggling. It's just that it doesn't have the resolution to properly make that smooth. You know, so... The fidals that I have two basically BMC 15s, which have, they actually don't have encoders like a modern digital servo would have. They have what are called resolvers instead, which is basically like a tiny little three-phase motor that's attached to your servo, and you feed an AC sine wave into it, and then it returns a different AC sine wave, and the CNC control uses the difference between those sine waves to work out how much the servo motor has turned. So this is a crazy analog system that they used to use, you know, back in the days of like punch cards and stuff, right? And it just kind of came forward with these DC fidals. When I say DC, I'm referring to the fact that the servos are brushed DC servos rather than like modern brushless AC servos. And the problem is that, like, the old school computer that's in the fidal, like, you know, your cell phone has, like, hundreds, possibly, well, definitely thousands of times of computing power of the like, computers in the fidal. Like,
right.
It's crazy how much more powerful that shit is. And also, one of the other things that's changed is the resolution of analog to digital converters. You know, so you're literally taking a sine wave that's coming out of these resolvers, kind of like an audio signal almost, and then converting it to a digital signal. And they're only getting 4,096 steps per revolution of the servo motor.
Right.
Whereas a modern CNC machine might get 1,000,000.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, yeah, it's a really, really big difference. So... The control upgrade actually doesn't replace the resolvers or anything. All it does is uses nicer analog to digital converters in order to get more resolution out of, because it's an analog system. The resolution is effectively infinite if you can quantify it well enough on the digital side, if that makes sense. So they're using nicer analog to digital converters to convert that resolver signal into a digital signal with double the resolution.
Right.
Which isn't crazy still compared to like, you know, a Makino F5 or something like that. You know, those machines are programmed in like nanometers, you know, like
right.
you can, the resolution they have is bonkers, but I don't need that. I just need it better.
Right. You know? That would be sick.
So,
but
yes. Yeah, but I don't have $250,000 US to throw at that. So,
well, we can at least go look at them at CMTS.
Oh, dude, if you catch me like licking it or something when the salesmen aren't looking, don't be surprised.
I definitely want to like play with something like you know, like a control, just to get a, like see what other controls are like. But yeah, no, that's cool. Like it's it seems like a no-brainer. I mean, $8,000 is not cheap, but if it's going to double your resolution, it could, even if it made that stair-step area much like better, but didn't completely solve the problem, it would still be, you know, probably super helpful for your production.
Yeah, it would still save me a lot of manual labor. Mm-hmm. I mean, the next option is to, there are other options, right? There's another control called the Next Gen control that's specifically designed again for FDALs. And that uses a completely different like motion core. Mm. You have to replace the resolvers with high resolution encoders and so on.
Okay, so it's a little bit more of an in-depth.
Yes, it's a much, much more serious like upgrade, and it would be difficult to reverse it as well.
Right.
Or I could go to something like Centroid CNC. They make like a standalone CNC control again. There are a lot of like retrofit options.
Yeah, interesting.
But the idea of something that's literally plug and play that I can return, you know, because if I buy something like the Centroid where it's, you know, you have to set it up custom to every machine and so on. If I tell them, oh, I'm not getting the surface finish that I want, they're going to be like, well, it's probably your machine.
Yeah.
You know, like your servos aren't good enough. Your setup isn't good enough, blah, blah, blah. Whereas these guys, it's designed specifically for the FDAL. They know the, you know, like the people in this company are actually, you know, descendants, like family members of the original people that owned the FDAL company. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I tell them, oh, I'm not getting the surface finish I want, they're going to be like, okay. And they'll take it back, you know. So
that sounds like
that is a very nice,
yeah, low risk.
Option. Yeah, exactly.
Because if it does what you want it to do, then that'd be huge.
It's worth way more than $8,000 to me.
Yeah, exactly.
I want it to do. Yeah. So yes, we'll see. I'm probably gonna push that to January because of what I was saying before about the mortgage. I need to make sure that my net income this year is as high as I can make it, and. You know, buying random shit doesn't help with that. So probably push it out to January, but that's fine. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens.
Yeah. So anything else new in the shop?
Nothing worth talking about. Nothing worth talking about. We've actually got listener questions. We should get into those. So I just want to give a quick shout out. I don't know if you remember a couple of episodes ago, we had someone write in to tell us information about cutting ABS and cutting cellulose.
Yes. Acetate. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. So she is on Instagram. Her Instagram handle is Farm Chick Engraving Service. So if you want something engraved and you're in the States or wherever, just reach out to Laura on Instagram. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out because last time she didn't have her business Instagram account associated with that. So
sweet.
We also, and another quick shout out, Baltic Blades on Instagram posted some stories during the week giving the XYZ.CNC podcast, which is us, and me personally a shout out, which was very cool because he just got his new CNC machine and it's running. It's a very cool like CNC router.
Wicked.
Making handle scales. And it looked wicked. He gave us a shout out. So it's a shout out coming back. It looked very cool. So go check out his stories with that CNC machine if you want to see, you know, a beefy but affordable machine. It's very cool.
Kick ass.
Yeah. We also see, we've been talking about superglue as a fixture a lot, right? So we had a longtime listener, Alexander Khan, write in with some advice, which is just saying that if you're making parts out of metal and you can heat them with a torch, then you can actually use the heat, you know, from a blowtorch or a heat gun to release the superglue quite easily if you just want to glue, you know, metal to metal rather than using superglue and tape.
Clever.
Yeah. So I haven't tried that. So use it at your own risk. But I have heard of other people doing it.
Yes. So we sometimes have to pull frets out of guitars and we superglue the frets in. And you can get a pretty nasty eye toke of super glue, like
eye toke?
Yeah. Evaporated super glue. Right. And that does suck. If you're gonna bust out that badass move with the blowtorch, I would I don't know. Maybe that just fucking would just eviscerate the super glue, but that's pretty.
Who knows? So what do you do to heat up the frets without burning the wood? Do you like use a soldering iron to heat the frets up or something?
We use a soldering iron, which is tricky sometimes because on a bound fretboard with the fretboard edge or sides of the fretboard are bound in ABS plastic, they can melt. So what I do is I put my fingers, I put two fingers on a finger on either end of the fret, and I heat it up along the middle until my fingers feel hot, and then I pull the fret. So nice. If I can withstand the heat, then the ABS usually can.
Getting some
using all your senses.
Yeah, there you go. Luthier.cnc. That's the new podcast that we're yeah, and so another question was Functional Crafts on Instagram said, what SLA printer were you recommending in one of the last episodes? So you actually saw this resin printer when you were at my shop the other day. It wasn't running, though. Mm-hmm. The printer itself is the Elegoo Mars 2 Pro.
Can you spell that?
Elegoo? It is spelled ELEGOO. Elegoo. It's one of those crazy Chinese company names, I think.
Nice. So it's the Elegoo
Mars 2 Pro.
Nice.
So the Mars 2 and the Mars 2 Pro are basically the same machine, just the Pro has a built-in activated carbon filter, and the regular one doesn't. I think there is also a difference that the build vat on the regular one. Oh God! Sorry.
There you go. Air compressor, a sneeze, sirens, cats.
Yeah,
this is a crazy episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the regular Mars 2 also just has like a plastic build volume, whereas the Mars 2 Pro has aluminum build vats.
So this is a resin printer.
It is, yeah, and it's a very inexpensive one. Like I think mine was like $300.
Yeah, I'm looking at Amazon. It's $399 Prime. You can get it tomorrow.
Mm. There you go. So yes, those are Canadian shekels. It's honestly a very good printer. The main issue for me is that I was buying it with the hope of being able to make end use parts. So I kind of bought it initially thinking I'm going to prototype parts for a folding knife, and you know what, it did that. It was pretty good. The issue is I was printing a lot of very thin and small parts, and the cleanup involved with removing supports would often kind of like destroy the dimensions that I was trying to test. So it didn't, like, I got some like aesthetic prototypes out of that, but not necessarily functional ones. You know, I was kind of hoping for functional. So then I was like, okay, what else can I use this for? And I tried printing parts for my sheaves. I actually tried printing entire sheaves. I really need to do a YouTube video about that. I've got like 25 3D printed sheets.
Oh, cool.
Here. Yeah. Different. Like I've got SLA, so which is the resin. I've got SLS, which is laser sintered plastic. I've got,
what's your SLS printer?
Oh, I don't have an SLS printer. Those are pricey.
Oh, so you got this.
Yeah.
You like had somebody prototype this for you?
That's correct. Yeah, I had an outside agency printed. And the problem with it, honestly, is there's two issues with the SLS prints. They look really nice, but when they wear, it kind of releases like powder.
Right, I remember you saying this, yeah.
Yeah, so when you're like sheathing and unsheathing the knife, the kind of lips of the sheath that hold the knife in place are kind of like letting all this powder go everywhere, and then it just gets all over the knife and it looks like shit. You know, which is not great optics. The other issue is that it's super expensive. You know, like one sheath costs like $30-$40 to have printed. You know, which I guess you can make it work if you really wanted to avoid the labor, but it's it's genuinely much less expensive for me to CNC, like thermoform them and CNC machine them. So, but yeah, the quality of the resin prints is really, really good. It really is. Like, I was using like engineering resins, which are designed to be tougher and stronger. Mainly the ones from a company called Soraya Tech. So it's spelled S-I-R-A-Y-A. And they have an engineering resin called Blue, which is, you know, tough, but hard. Like, it's pretty darn good, but it's still not as strong as like a good FDM print, like a good, you know, hot glue gun style,
right,
3D print. So yeah, like the parts that I was kind of hoping to use it for were the scout carry mounts, for my sheaths, which kind of lets you carry the knife on your belt sideways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm printing those on my shitty FDM printer, at the shop, printing them in carbon fiber reinforced polycarbonate, which is a pretty bonkers material. Like, it's very, very strong. Yeah, so it depends what you want to use it for. If you're going to use it for, like, you know, fit and feel kind of prototypes, fantastic. For functional end use parts,
right?
I would be. I don't think it's quite there, unfortunately.
What kind of FDM printer do you have?
I have a, oh god, what's it called? It is an Anycubic Cosel Linear Plus.
Okay. And yeah, do you like it?
I would say it's a don't buy.
Oh, interesting. What?
It's okay. So it's what's called a Delta printer, which basically means that it has three linear rails arranged in a triangle with the rails going vertical. And then it moves those three kind of arms to move the print head around the extruder. The problem is just that there's a lot of slop in that mechanism. It also means that the drive motor for the extruder has to be mounted remotely away from the extruder. So the part that's pushing the plastic filament is away from the part that's melting it.
Okay.
And that system is called a Bowden drive setup. They're kind of common, but they're not as good as a direct drive, like just having the extrusion motor mounted directly to the extruder. So yeah, I wouldn't buy it. Like, if someone wants to buy an inexpensive FDM printer, like, honestly, the Prusa printers, like the Prusa Mini, they're kind of like the standard at right. this point, you know.
I am interested in getting one, I will say.
Yeah, they are fantastic because the material is really inexpensive. Like, if you're buying like PLA, which is kind of the bread and butter 3D printing material, you know, so I've used that for printing like little parts bins. You know, I wanted to get those like red plastic parts bins, but I had some like weird shaped drawers, like little tiny parts drawers that the bins wouldn't fit in. So I just printed some myself, you know, and they cost like 15 cents each to print, wow. You know. And it's not like the ultimate strongest material, but it's more than strong enough for that application. I actually have on the front of Vicky, on the front of my CNC machine, I have a caddy that's directly attached to the enclosure that holds my impact driver, two torque wrenches, screwdriver, and a couple of other things. That's all 3D printed in PLA. It's like, you know, a couple of bucks worth of PLA. It's exactly what I needed. I just modeled it up in Fusion, you know, 10 minutes in Fusion, and then it took like 8 hours or 9 hours to print, but you just like, you click print, yeah, and you walk away.
Oh man, that's,
you
know, sweet.
You don't have to make fixtures, you don't have to do anything, right? So yeah, a good FDM printer, one that's like reliable and prints without you having to babysit it, is an asset in any shop, right. I would say. Like,
that's what I keep
just being hearing. Able to print little things here and there, even if it is stupid stuff like parts bins and whatever, it's super helpful when you need something, you know, like I use these little stones to hand sand all of my blades called mold polishing stones, and they're kind of uncomfortable to hang on to because they're small and sharp edged, so I just 3D printed a little holder for it, you know, like,
yeah, that's sweet.
Yeah, it's super, super helpful having that capability in a shop.
I just want to, yeah, like, I think I probably would figure out some good uses for it, but I also just kind of want to play with it. It seems fun.
Yeah, totally. They're really interesting compared to a CNC mill because they're very low stress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there is a crash or something, or the part lifts off the build plate or whatever, Nothing happens.
Right.
You know, like, it's very hard to kill one, I think. You know, like, I've certainly tried with mine. I haven't managed.
What about the SLA printers? Are they any more fragile?
Yes. Yeah, there are. So basically, in an SLA printer, in a resin printer, most of the ones at the moment anyway, you have like an LCD screen that's underneath the build vat, and then you have the build vat. And the bottom of the build vat is this material called FEP. It's almost like a drum, like the head of a snare drum. It's that kind of like really thin, strong, stretchy plastic, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So if you have a build fail in a resin printer, what will happen is the cured resin will be stuck to that stretchy plastic thing in the bottom. And you have to like get the cured resin off it without scratching the like, you know, plastic sheet. Because if you scratch the plastic sheet, then that little scratch will show up in every single 3D print that you do in the future. You know, if you like spill the resin into the LCD screen or something, or in between the FEP and the LCD screen, and it cures there, then you've basically like killed your LCD screen. You have to replace it. Oof. The LCD screen dies after 2,000 hours anyway, and you have to replace it. Yeah, using a resin printer, and then like if everything goes well, you have to like take your parts out, you know, scoop all the goo off them, wash them in isopropyl alcohol, cure them, you know, cut the supports off. Like, resin printers have their place, especially if you're doing like miniatures or like sculpting work or, mm-hmm. or whatever, but they are definitely a lot more fussy than an FDM printer.
Yeah, it seems like the FDM printer is the place to start for someone like me who just wants to make little widgets and such.
You know, and the other thing is too that, so FDM printing, like, you know, there's no bad smells unless you're printing like ABS, and even then in a workshop environment, like whatever, you're probably smelling worse stuff all the time. The like PLA and ABS is like dirt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can get a kilogram of PLA for like $20, like good quality.
On
PLA.
Amazon, probably.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a company in Canada that I really like, just called filaments.ca. And I just order all my stuff from them. They have everything from like, you know, plain Jane PLAs and ABS all the way up to the carbon fiber polycarbonate that I'm using. And, you know, the price varies between like $20 a kilo to like $150 a kilo or even more. Like, you can get some pretty crazy materials for FDM printers. But having that inexpensive, like, you know, $20 a kilogram PLA means that, like, you know, printing things like those little parts bins, it's so inexpensive that like it genuinely competes with like buying cheap ones from like Amazon or whatever in terms of price,
like
you know,
molded
like little injection molded
ones.
I mean, that's pretty bonkers for like, you know, custom made in your shop. Like, there's no other way to do that in your shop unless you have like an injection mold machine and you're willing build a mold.
That would be insane. <You know?
laughs> Yeah. So yeah, they're very, very cool. I would definitely recommend, like, anyone that has a workshop, you will 100% find a use for one.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make filter banks for the Haas for the control cabinet.
Okay.
So I ended up just magneting some filter material to the back of the cabinet. Right. It works. But then I saw Jay Pearson made these little 3D printed magnet sort of they capture the furnace filter and magnet it to the back of the cabinet. And I was like, oh, that. So such a more elegant solution than my just, you know, order some magnets on McMaster and
it's crazy what becomes easy and practical when there's no labor involved in like actually fabricating the thing.
No, and the design stuff would be fun.
Yeah, 100%. Well, speaking of control cabinet filtering, if you go on the Marital website, they have a new product called Vellum filters.
I was looking into Vellum. That's what gave me the idea for the way I did it. I ended up just buying filter bank material from McMaster in a roll.
Right.
But so Meritools, because I was trying to, I was going to buy it on CNC repair guy.com mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. but the shipping was really expensive.
Yeah, CNC repairman.
Yeah, CNC repairman, the stick figure guy.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so Meritool are a distributor of that stuff now. And yeah, it's a really clever idea. It's like literally like a little roll of filter paper on like a kind of pull-out dispenser. And part of the dispenser goes over the top of your inlet. And then when it's dirty, you just kind of pull it through more and then tear off the dirty bit. And there's a fresh filter.
It's great.
It's super smart. Yeah. So buy one of those.
Oh, Meritool, you've done it again.
All right. I think one more listener question and then we're done for the day. So I had Rudolf Diesel Service on Instagram write in saying that he wanted to clear the air regarding Waterjet. So in the past, I've said that I've tried Waterjet and I wasn't super happy with it. You know, I was seeing a lot of taper and like not great.
Is this for your like blanking out
tolerances?
Your
yes, knife? Yeah, for blanking out knives. And so he said, I own a Flow brand 5-axis water jet that runs 94,000 psi of water. Holy and I can shit. Adjust for taper. It'll machine parts to a perfect 90 degrees with a tolerance of 3,000 at 36 inch distance, like a 36 inch thickness.
Oh my god, 94,000 psi, that's what bonkers.
Yeah. These types of water jets are all over the world. Mine will cut 18 inch thick material. So sorry, he must say when he says tolerance of 3,000 at 36, he means like, I guess like if you cut a 36 inch long bar, he can hold 3,000 width along that.
Seems pretty good.
So you can cut 18 inch material, cutting 6 inch thick. He can hold 1,000 tolerances with no draft, almost perfect 90 degree walls. So yeah, I have heard of these machines before. But I don't know of that many companies that have 5-axis water jets. You know, like when I talk to a company about getting knife blanks cut, they're generally running a 3-axis water jet.
Mm-hmm. Could you just search 5-axis water jets Toronto?
I guess so. Yeah, I know that there's a company in the States called like O2 Machining or something like that. They do a lot of work for knife makers and I know they run a 5-axis water jet. I would love to see some parts, like a comparison between 3-axis and 5-axis. It sounds like it's a lot more capable.
Yeah.
You know, like for me, when I was getting, so I was getting parts cut out of 5/32 of an inch thick, so 4 millimeter thick A2 tool steel on a 3-axis water jet. And I was getting striations in the parts, so like the cut edges were a little wavy.
Right.
They were also not perfectly 90 degrees, even at that relatively thin
material. That's surprising.
There was like definitely a noticeable taper. The pinholes, I was having them cut pinholes, and the pinholes were like way off tolerance, and they also had like little tabs left inside the pinholes. That I think was a programming issue. They probably could have programmed it to, you know, overlap the cut a little bit and get rid of that. But basically, you know, so I got all these nice quote unquote parts from my 3-axis water jet place. And then I still had to do a bunch of finishing work on all those cut surfaces, mm-hmm. you know? So for me, it just didn't make any sense.
Well, and now you're using it for work holding you don't necessarily want a blank.
No, exactly. I just want rectangles, mm-hmm. but you know, for another knife maker that is going to be like finishing everything by hand, then like having blanks cut out on water jet can make a ton of sense because then, you know, you have three models, you get 20 of each of them cut out. You just have the stock there ready to start grinding on it. And then you're going to clean up all the edges anyway, because you're going to be grinding the edges to fit your handle scales and stuff. Like, it does make a ton of sense in that case.
Sure.
Interestingly, I would say in that case, I'm not sure how much of an advantage a 5-axis water jet would be, because you're going to be grinding all those surfaces anyway.
Right.
You know what I mean?
You're not needing to hold those high tolerances.
Yes, but definitely, like, if you're a machine shop and you want, like, really nice, you know, blanks out of, like, hard or thick material, then it sounds like a 5-axis water jet, like what he's running, would be amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, because they can cut marble, they can cut steel and carbide, they can cut like all sorts of crazy shit on a water jet. That's just not really possible to cut any other way.
It's super cool technology.
Yeah, and like you said, 94,000 PSI.
That's mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing. And it's kind of interesting, like, the way that they make some of these parts is actually by machining, you know, so for, like, little vessels and stuff that are in the plumbing system that are supposed to hold that level of pressure, they, like, machine them or, you know, roll them and weld them. And then they actually fill them with even more pressure and, like, crush the steel. They actually, like, form and strengthen the steel. It's almost like cold rolling. But you're doing it with pressure. Huh. I forget the name of the process, but like without that process, the parts won't even survive. You know, 94,000 psi of
pressure. I hadn't even thought about that. Like, you know, we buy air fittings and they're rated to like 300 psi. Now, what they would actually hold, I don't know, but this is significantly more pressure.
Yeah, I mean, usually those like class 150, class 125 air fittings, their actual burst pressure would be like, you know, 1,000 PSI, 2,000 PSI.
Right.
It's not going to be 94,000 PSI, that's for damn sure. Yeah, and even like hydraulic fittings, usually they're only rated to like 5 or 6,000 PSI. So 94,000 PSI is bonkers numbers.
Yeah, so cool.
Well, I think that's the end of our time together for this week.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go do some Googling. I want to look at one of these five-axis water jets, and I'm gonna look into a 3D printer.
Oh, you absolutely should. Have a look at the Prusa Mini. I'll have a poke around and just kind of remind myself of the other options.
Creality was another one I kept hearing.
Yeah, the Creality Ender 3. Is a very, very common first choice for sure. I would say the one of the really nice things about like the Prusa is that, so especially with the Mini, it just comes in like two parts and you bolt the two parts together and then you're good to go. They have their own slicer called Prusa Slicer that comes preloaded with like all of the profiles for different materials. So you're like, oh, I want to print PLA. They've got a profile for that. I want to print it PLA fast or really detailed or whatever. They've got everything set up in there and you just print. You know, I don't think that there are many, if any, other companies that offer that level of like out of the box experience. Certainly not at like an inexpensive retail price point. Like if you want to buy like a Markforged 3D printer, you know, they're $7,000 and they have their own slicer and you like can't change settings. Because their settings work,
right?
You know, you have to use their material, you have to use their slicer, and it just works.
No, this thing's like cantilever.
So
right?
Yeah,
the Prusa Mini, like the
It's the x-axis, I guess it is like hanging out with one end in space. Which, you know, you and I are used to thinking about like CNC mills and woodworking machinery and stuff. And we're like, oh, that's not going to work. But like a 3D printer doesn't really have any forces acting on the extruder. So, I mean, I've seen tons of prints off the Prusa Mini and they look beautiful.
Sick.
So yeah, I mean, that's kind of like, you know, they used to say back in the day, like nobody gets fired for buying IBM. Like if you were buying information technology, like computers and stuff for your company, you just like buy IBM laptops, buy IBM desktops, and you're not going to get fired. You know, it's going to work. That's kind of my thing with Prusa. Like I'm recommending it to you because
it works.
You're not going to be sad.
Right.
It's just going to work. You know? It has a ton of really nice stuff built in. Like the automated, like the mesh bed leveling is really nice. It has a non-contact inductive touch probe for sensing where the bed of the machine is.
Oh, cool.
You know, whereas like my printer, I have to like attach this stupid mechanical switch underneath the encoder and then it's kind of inconsistent. Underneath the extruder. It's kind of inconsistent as to how well it works. And like one time I forgot to remove it before starting a print and crashed the machine. Oh. You know? Whereas like on the Prusa, it just sits there next to the spindle, next to the extruder all the time. And it's not in the way. It just works, you know? So, yeah, I mean, the difference between the Ender 3 and the Prusa is basically price.
Right. So it's like twice the price almost for the Prusa.
For the Prusa Mini, yeah. Right? Yeah. I would say the upsides on the Prusa Mini, though, Prusa as a company are like really strongly committed to open source. They release like all of the designs for their printers, like the firmware, all sort like their slicer, everything is open source and people can contribute from the community back to the programs, to their designs. They really seem to stand behind their product. Like you can like live chat someone at Prusa and say like, I'm having trouble with my printer, and they'll help you fix it, you know, which is not, that's not the case with like any other 3D printing right. company.
Yeah. Really. That would be handy.
Not unless you're buying like a $5,000 printer.
Right. Cause I'll need the help.
Right. So yeah, I mean, yeah, as I said, like, I don't think you're going to be sad if you buy a Prusa.
Okay.
Whereas the Ender 3 is probably going to be a bit more of an inconsistent learning process. Right. They're like very common printers. There's tons of information on them out there, but I think you'll pretty quickly get to the point where you kind of want to upgrade this or fix that, or you'll be like tweaking profiles and tightening stuff or whatever, you know, like, yeah, I don't know if that's the experience that you want.
No. Cool. Right on. Sold.
Sweet. Well, next episode, I expect you to have a 3D printer.
Well, sold in my head. I'm going to...
Just go buy it. Just go buy it. Or you can buy mine, and I'll buy a nicer one.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. Perfect. All right, everybody. Lovely hanging out with you all, as always. And we will speak to you again next week.
All righty. Cheers.
Bye, everyone.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.